The Garden Question is a podcast for people that love designing, building, and growing smarter gardens that work. Listen in as we talk with successful garden designers, builders, and growers, discovering their stories along with how they think, work, and grow. This is your next step in creating a beautiful, year-round, environmentally connected, low-maintenance, and healthy, thriving outdoor space. It doesn't matter if you're a beginner or an expert, there will always be something inspiring when you listen to the Garden Question podcast. Hello, I'm your host, Craig McManus. In this episode, Jenny Rose Carey, a seasoned horticulturalist, shares how her garden thrives with her smart water-wise practices. Despite 45 inches of rain annually, she emphasizes harmony with natural weather patterns, practical tips, and personal anecdotes. She offers valuable insight into tricks and sustainable practices that she applies in her garden. Born into a family of botanists and gardeners in England, she is now dedicated to sharing her expertise through writing, speaking, and tending her garden, Northview, in Philadelphia. Her degrees are in biology, horticulture, and education. Professionally, she has been director of two public gardens, the Ambler Arboretum of Temple University and the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society's garden at Meadowbrook Farm. This is episode 158, Smart Water Practices and Your Garden, with Jenny Rose Carey on the Garden Question Podcast. Jenny Rose, why do you spend so much time thinking about water in your garden?
I think that it might be that I'm a very parsimonious person. I live on a hill. The original way that I got water for my garden was to fill up a watering can in my kitchen sink. My first garden was my herb garden. Many herbs don't really need very much water. That was a sort of coping mechanism. One of my other gardens that was early on, I decided in 2003 that I was going to put in a dry garden. Those of you listening in Denver and California and other places where it's truly dry will laugh because I get about 45 inches of rain a year, but it comes in fits and starts. So you might have 6 inches of rain, 4 inches of rain, 3 inches of rain, and then nothing for a few weeks. So the dry garden idea was born out of hanging out with many landscape architects who specify in-ground sprinkling systems as part of their designs. I really felt that was very wasteful of drinking water that comes out of our taps. That's the short answer, but I do spend a lot of time thinking about water.
That intrigues me that you have a dry garden with 45 inches of rain. How does that work?
There wasn't at the time. Now there's a lot more about xeriscapes and dry gardens. Back in the early 2000s, there wasn't very much. Maybe if you lived in really dry climates, more like 17 inches of rain, you were thinking about it. But even there, I don't think there was much literature out at that point. What I found was I really took a botanical approach to it, where I looked for plants like the herbs. Actually, one of the plants that I wanted to grow in there was lavender, because the year before we'd been to Provence in the south of France and seen these fields of lavender growing with no irrigation, no tending, and basically growing in very gritty and stony soil. I'm like, oh, that's why my lavender's not growing in my herb garden. Let's make a garden to grow lavender. That is going to be this dry garden. It was born of several ideas, really.
What are some common misconceptions about managing water in the garden?
I strongly believe that you need to garden within what falls from the heavens, basically, for the large part of your garden. Obviously, I am a big grower of flowers. Everyone who knows me knows that. I grow a lot of annuals, and many vegetables require a significant amount of input of water. I still work out ways of not wasting water, even with those. I think that the strong idea that you look and see, obviously, this does lean into native plants that we know grow well in your climate, whether you water them or not, after the first tending of them and getting them established. I think that's really what my whole message to people is. Yes, you can have your vegetables and your annuals and your containers, but work out ways to limit the waste. That gets back to my original comment of being parsimonious and cheap.
How are you capturing that water and benefiting your garden with it?
Another whole principle, it's something that I think as garden writers we're talking more and more about, is keeping as much water as falls on your property for as long as possible to infiltrate back into the soil rather than running down storm drains, causing flooding downstream. I know my trees benefit from it. I know my plants benefit from it. The idea of infiltration, helping your garden be a soakaway for the water that falls on your garden. And I do that by making swales so that the water will sit in them for a while and gradually sink in, and rain gardens. So I have a lovely rain garden that really doesn't meet most people's idea of a rain garden because it sits there for longer, but it's almost like a vernal pond. I don't know if people know what that is, but vernal means spring. In our area of the mid-Atlantic, there used to be in farms and countryside areas where water would sit in the spring because we get our April showers, as is happening right now. It would sit there. I dug up a salamander the other day. I know I'm doing something right. We have the spring peepers that people think are birds, but they're making such a racket right now. Sits in that basin base. I dug out the middle of it and made a horseshoe shape of soil behind it on the downward side. That just stops it enough that it keeps it there and lets it sink back in. I have other ones, and I think we might be talking about some of the other ways that I get water to get back into the ground.
It's basically capturing the rainwater. In other seasons where you're not getting rain, it's dry.
Yes, it is. But by then, the frogs have moved on somewhere else. I do have ponds. People don't realize that lawn, especially closely cut lawn or turf, water sheets off that. You go out in a rainstorm and you watch. That's what I did. I actually went out. I have a whole collection of Wellington boots. So I went out, watched where the water flowed in my garden, and realized that if I dug a pond in a certain position, I could collect all the water that flows off that bit of lawn and make a nice pond. I don't put anything on my lawn. I don't spray it. I don't fertilize it. It has plenty of clover in it, which is another whole thing that people need to understand. I'm not worried about extra pesticides or herbicides or fertilizers in the pond. We even have a snapping turtle that lives in that pond. I got so excited about that that I wanted to have dragonflies, so I dug a whole nother pond on that side. I have a swale on that side, and then I have this new newspaper wall collection basin slash ditch that I'm making on another corner. So yes, it's very involved. I also have hugel cultures, which are the permaculture where you have rotting logs and then pile up organic matter and extra soil and leaf mold and compost on top of it, then basically let it rot down in place and all the things that grow on top of it extract the water and nutrients from the logs. That is like a big old sponge, basically, because the water falls on it and it's like this into the hugel culture. Hugel is just the German word for hill, if you're looking up H-U-G-E-L. That's what that is. It's a crazy garden, so you have to come and visit, Craig.
Yes, I look forward to visiting, hopefully sooner than later. You've mentioned soakaways. Admit, I had to look that up when we were talking before the podcast, and I realized I've built those, but I hadn't heard that term. So could you explain to us what a soakaway is?
Even when I was a child, we had soakaways. My dad is a botanist. He lives in England, obviously, as you can tell from the accent. In England, it seems to be much more common for water. So that's things coming out of your bathtub, your washing up sink. Maybe they have dishwashers now, but they didn't when I was growing up. I was the dishwasher. In several of the houses, my dad is a botanist, but he's very handy and things like that. So instead of having the bath water, and there was a lot of it, there were four girls. I'm the oldest of four girls. He wanted it to divert. He dug a ditch, put in stones, and the bath water came out of a separate pipe. It didn't go into the drains and came out into this soakaway, then gradually seeped in. It helps your groundwater to be more of it, and especially during a drought. as long as you're not using nasty chemicals in your washing up liquid water and things like that, or your bath, then there's not much in there, maybe a bit of soap. But the rocks and other debris that you fill up the hole with really just help. Then over time, that just decomposes and just seems to go back into the groundwater. Here we're much more, oh, it's all got to go down the drain type thing. I think we really need, and this is beyond my pay grade because I'm not an engineer, we need to get this into new housing where this is acceptable, that this water that's not really that dirty doesn't have to be retreated in the sewage works and things like that. That's my short version of that, Craig. I hope that helps.
Yes. In my mind, I can see a newspaper wall, but what in reality is that?
When I've told people about this, they Google it, and apparently the first thing to come up is the interior design where you actually wallpaper your walls with old sheets of newspaper or cartoons or something like that. Years and years ago, I think I saw this rather than dreamt about it, but I do have crazy dreams about things I'm going to do in my garden, so I've no idea now. It's too long ago. But I like to read a physical newspaper. I sit down, read it, and then I'm like, now what am I going to do? Yes, it can go in the recycling bin, but who knows whether that's actually going to be recycled. So I thought, good organic matter. I already use newspaper, as many people do, like around my vegetable beds as the bottom of my path. Then I put salt hay on top of it, which is a great weed suppressing thing, about 8 to 10 layers of your newspaper. That's a good tip. I thought we bundle them up with jute twine that is biodegradable. So I thought, wow, they look like bricks. We basically built a low brick wall using bricks of newspaper tied together with garden twine. It's over by my Hugel cultures. So I'm like, okay, now I'm going to cover it with soil. I dug out the middle in the sort of horseshoe shape, covered the newspaper with it. Then I'm adding some stones, and we've added what you might call a dead hedge, where you put pieces of wood in and then you weave a wattle hedge and into twine. My lovely gardener, Hannah, does that, and she's very creative. You need to just be able to go for it for that sort of thing. But it's a lot of visitors, Craig, to Northview. I don't want to shock people because my garden is not the same as everybody else's. When I go to visit gardens, I don't want them to be all the same. I want them to be thought-provoking. I want them to be full of birds. I want them to be creative in my ideal world. But I want people to come around the garden and really think of ways that they could install a few rain barrels or maybe let some things rot down in place rather than getting rid of them. Unless it's diseased or horrible, and we do have a green bin recycling through the township where they have massive piles of compost. I do send some stuff there. The rest of it, like logs and things, I keep on the property because I want that organic stuff that has grown in my garden to be in my garden and decompose. I have skunks and all these other animals that rifle through decomposing. I have three kinds of woodpeckers, flickers, and all these wonderful birds that use these standing stumps and the logs that are around my shade garden and everything. It's just a busy place.
You mentioned stumps, and I've heard you refer to stumpery. I can imagine all these stumps. I don't know if they're turned upside down or right side up, or how does that work?
I said it's a crazy place. The house is from 1887. It's a Victorian house. I'm a garden historian, amongst my other things. Victorians loved to use roots to make rooteries and stumps to make stumperies. If a tree blows over, which we had a tornado a few years ago, we had even more stumps to use. The root structure is so fascinating. It started when we were digging up, can't remember what type of tree it was. Maybe it was an ailanthus that is a very invasive tree here in the mid-Atlantic. I chopped them down and they were still sprouting. I know what happened. Started with just a watering can in the kitchen sink. This was the plumber and the electrician. I wanted an outlet and an outdoor tap. One of them had a backhoe. And I said, while you're here, can you dig up the stumps of the ailanthus? So this poor plumber is, oh, what the heck is this lady up to? They came out of the ground and they were just really cool. I think they were orange and everything like that. He said, I can take these away for you, lady. I'm like, no, I want them. You can imagine his face at that point. I got the chance to go to King Charles III. He has a wonderful garden called Highgrove in the Cotswolds. My dad lives in the Cotswolds. So I've been to King Charles's when he was prince a couple of times. Can't take photos, but he has a massive stumpery. There's another one if people want to go and visit it in England or look online. The National Trust of England has a website. If you look up Biddulph, B-I-D-U-L-P-H, Grange, you will see their stumpery. That one is from Victorian times. It is an eclectic pastiche sort of garden. Once I found out other people had them, I'm like, oh, yes, that's going to be a thing. Oh, to answer your question, the roots are turning upwards. I have had some people think that it looks a bit scary, especially in the dark. It's like those shadows and everything. I grow ferns, epimediums, snowdrops, and what else do I have? Oh, coming up now is Mertensia, the Virginia bluebells. I have a whole patch of those over there. It's been there for 20-odd years, 25 years now. It rots down, but that's my whole approach to gardening is the cycle of nature. You are looking at that decomposing, not to get sort of too philosophical and earth to earth and dust to dust sort of type thing, but you realize that your garden is a place of living, evolving, and changing rather than a static composition that somebody comes in, designs, and says, here, we are done. It's part of the process of life. And then you have to go and find another stump. I have trash picked them before, and you should have seen the lady's face.
I pick her these stumps.
My next door neighbor is a children's camp. And with this tornado and various other things, they've had trees blow over. I have had ones that have come in with a boom thing over the fence. They gave it to me. I have a nice guy that I work with on the garden to do a lot of the installation. And he looks out when he's on a job and he says, I found a stump for you. In it comes. And then we have to redesign everything to make room for the stump.
Do you wash the soil off the roots when you turn it upside down?
Interestingly, I've done both because the soil protects it for longer. It depends whether it comes out of a very clay soil, which we have pockets of clay around here, and then it will stay on for ages. The one that came over the fence, I really wanted to see what the structure was like. I did work at it with the hose and get a lot of the soil off. If you're in a sandy area, it will mostly fall off anyway. It depends how fast or slow you want the process to be.
A lot of gardens have water that passes through from the neighbor upstream. How do you handle that? Do you try to capture that water that's passing through, or do you send it on down below?
Interestingly, I sit on the watershed between the Delaware and Schuylkill Rivers. I am at the top of the hill. If I didn't do all the things I was doing, I would be sending my water to somebody else. I have gardened and advised on various gardens where they do have water coming through, and especially if a new development gets put in upstream or something like that. It is a problem. Where my daughter was living, she had a big stream that came through, and in times of heavy rainfalls, it can cause devastation. You've got to watch that. But if you actually have a stream, you can slow it down by putting little dams in, or you can make puddles, widen it out at places and make lake-like structures. Even putting some more boulders into it can slow down the flow if you're worried about it. That gets into the realm of you really need somebody that knows what they're doing with water flow. But if it's just from your neighbor's garden, when it's not too much, I would be grateful for it unless it's causing flooding. If it is causing flooding, then either you talk to your neighbor and say, have you thought about having a rain barrel? You might need it to water your container plants. Or like one of my friends did was really make a bog garden, and the bottom of her garden got water from the back neighbors. And so she said, oh my goodness, I'm going to just make it into a boggy garden and grow lots of red lobelia and turtle head and filipendula, all those things, the meadow sweet, all the things that struggle if they don't get enough water. A lot depends on the volume and how often those rain events happen. Pretty much case by case, I would think. But if you can use it, might as well use it if it's coming through.
How much do you think the way we've been taught how to water contributes to our water shortages at times?
I think that is a very true statement. The other thing is if you don't mind, I'd love to talk about the way we water, because I get asked about this all the time. And I was at the dentist office. I had my mouth open and there's 10 tools in there. And the hygienist is saying, oh, you have to floss your teeth. I'm like, I know I do. But then she says, oh, I've been struggling with watering my plants. I'm like, oh my goodness, I've got 10 tools in there. How am I going to answer it? Basically, she was doing what most people do, which is to go out every evening and water your plants that you've just planted. Basically, she was encouraging, by doing it little and often, the roots of her perennials to grow up to the surface rather than down. I joke about how I raised my children. I'm a bit of the more of the authoritarian of the two of us. They had to grow up and do things themselves. And I do that with my plants too. That's the whole thing with the dry garden that hasn't been watered for 20 years. I put those things in and they might have got a bucket of water when they went in, but then they got nothing else. If you do that, they're either meant to be in that dry garden environment or they're not. A lot of your maintenance patterns really influence whether you can grow certain plants and how drought tolerant they are. If you are always watering them at the first sign of drooping and watering them a little bit, all the roots are up at the top. If you water them once a week while you're establishing them and water down very deeply and then leave them alone, even if you have hot weather or whatever, those roots will extend low into the soil, especially if you're growing prairie plants. If you do a cross section through a prairie, they're down 3-4 feet, maybe deeper for some of the things. If you're growing tough plants that are either native to your area or native somewhere else in the US, let them get their roots down. It's different vegetables. They have a very short life, most of them, unless they're perennials like rhubarb or some of the fruit trees and things. But if you're growing annuals, they're only living for a few weeks, so you have to look after them and give them more water.
I have to remind folks sometimes that they're not washing the plants, that they're actually needing that water to soak in. Huh? What's the best technique you use for soaking in water?
Oh, well, I'm a bit lean and mean. I don't fertilize very much and I don't water very much. If I can not water, because I'm still on the well, that hasn't changed. I'm lucky, Craig, that I have very good soil. But if you can improve your soil, add plenty of organic matter and or grit for all of these plants, you've got to look at the requirements for that plant, see whether it's more on the grit-loving and stone-loving, or whether it's more woodsy, that is a shade-loving thing, match your soil to it, then work out basically how much water does this thing need, then cluster the things that need the same watering requirements together, so that if you're on a once-a-week regime, they should be all together. To heck with the design. Those ones all need to be together. And the ones that need watering once a month, you guys go over there. I do a lot of thinking about that too.
Do you ever water with a hose?
I do use a hose. My herb garden is still there after 24 years. It does have quite a few things that I add in, like some salvias, marigolds, nasturtiums. They will need watering. I'm not saying that I don't water things. I don't use soaker hoses and drip irrigation. I know some people swear by. My gardens are more dynamic than that. In some of the places I've worked, we've had soaker hoses and hidden them under mulch and things like that. The gardeners would just get so mad and come into the office and tell me all the latest horror stories, because if you put soaker hoses, it's fine if it's a shrub border. But if you're doing the type of intensive gardening that I do and that we did when I was at Temple University or at Meadowbrook, you can't do it because you are changing things out and you are constantly digging a hole for a bulb and then you hit the soaker hose again and then you have to mend it or pull it out. It ends up being too much work. Spot watering as needed for the new things that go in by hose and watering cans. I have a lovely collection of old watering cans.
They're just not ornamental then, are they?
Oh, no, they still look nice, but they're not just ornamental. You're correct.
Yeah, I see a lot of collections of watering cans. They don't look like they've ever been used. They were used a lot at one time, but they're just,
yeah,
they're there for the aesthetic.
Mine is sitting on the wall out there right now, what I have to do in the next week or so before we start garden tours in less than 2 weeks. Now I've hosed bibs various places of the garden, usually put one or two by each hose bib. And it's fun.
It's relaxing. I like the water.
Yes. The other thing that happens when you water is you are paying attention to your plants. You are with your plants. It is meditative. As you're walking down your bed, you're saying, what's going on with you? Oh, I see you have a few aphids today. Do you need to squish them? Oh, I see you have a lily beetle today. I'm definitely going to squish you. So you're being very observant about your plants and you're in amongst them and relating to them. And I agree with the meditative thing. I think that's very true.
Now, you like to experiment. What are some experiments that you have underway regarding watering?
The newspaper wall is the biggest one because I've got the extension to the newspaper wall now that's in process. It hasn't really been planted up. I've been trying to work out a bit of a color scheme. I'm thinking of more whites and pastels over there. Then you watch, it'll be orange. I bought some oriental poppies. I bet they're orange, not white. You just wait. The best laid plans. I'm doing that. I continue to experiment with new flowers from seed. I'm a big seed sower. I've never found a packet of seed I can't really love. I keep buying new seed. In the herb garden I keep referring to is the one that I'm most hands-on. Hannah, who works for me, does a lot more of the other things. We work together on things, but I'm often off giving lectures or going to England or something like that. The herb garden is my sort of baby. At the weekend, I was doing a lot more scattering of seed because, as I said, I buy too many seeds, so there's some older ones. I'm like, okay, instead of growing them in modules or in the, we have a cold greenhouse that we use and a garage, I'm going to scatter them and make it more cottage garden. So I'm reverting to my roots and going back to cottage garden style, I think, Craig, this year. And also lots of herbs because I've got the Herb Society of America coming to my garden in June.
I was thinking most people don't get newspapers anymore, but we get a lot of packages. What do you think about a cardboard wall where you do the same technique you were doing in newspapers, but do it with cardboard? Have you tried that?
Cardboard I have used instead of newspaper under salt hay. Along paths, cardboard can buckle. You do have to take all the tape off and all the label or your address label is too shiny. That won't break down. So you need to rip all the packing tape off if it's not biodegradable. But there's no reason why you can't use it as a base of a hugel culture. Just do that. Anything that rots down is good. As you know from composting, if you actually want it to rot down, you probably want to do layering. So you would do a layer of cardboard, a layer of soil or organic matter, a layer of cardboard, and then some compost, some leaf mold, some extra soil that you have from digging a vegetable bed or something. Just layer it in what they sometimes call a lasagna method or a tiramisu method. And I thought that was even better because it has, I think that sounds very yummy. I would do that because then it actually will rot down because that will be quite dry in there. It's interesting, back to the water thing. You would think that water would percolate all the way down through the hill and get to the bottom. But even with the newspaper, I found that it took a while for it to get wet through to the middle. And I've actually left the bundles out there right now to wet down a bit because I do want them to rot down, basically.
Could you soak them? Just put them in a bucket or something like that and speed that process up?
I do that with my newspaper on the paths often because it's always a windy day. And I was actually doing a video for somebody about how I do the paths with the newspaper. And all of a sudden, a gust of wind comes and all the newspaper, it was hilarious. It did try again. But yes, they do blow all over the place. Could wet them down with a hose after each layer. Yeah, good idea.
You were talking about your walkways. I guess all of them are permeable?
Yes, all of them are permeable. We did have a permeable driveway that was actually just an old driveway that had disintegrated. And the girls kept sliding over on their bikes and injuring themselves. We went to a tarmac driveway, but I don't see any problem with that because it's sloped. They're all always sloped to the sides anyway. So as long as it's sinking in off the sides, I think that's fine because you're still using that water. I use chipped gravel. One of the things I really dislike strongly is landscape fabric, especially the plasticky ones, because so many of the gardens I've been in, it gets stuck through roots, and then they plant an azalea on top and all the azalea roots are in it, and then you're just ripping bits here, and there's bits of plastic throughout the whole soil. I never use landscaping fabric under my paths. We clear them either by hand-pulling, raking, hoeing, or by a weed burner with the propane. You do have to wear like steel toe cap things on your shoes, no flip-flops, and do not do it if you have a wooden house. Don't do any of that burning stuff around your wooden house or next to pine straw or any of those things that can be flammable. Just have to use your common sense when you're doing it. Even my bluestone paths are dry laid. They have a base of several inches of what we call screenings that are tamped down. Then you butt the stones together. There is a little crack and you dribble some screenings down the crack. So all of it is dry laid. Water finds its own way. I'm a bit obsessed with it. Maybe that's what was coming out of this conversation. I didn't even realize.
I think we need to be more obsessed with water and treat it as a precious resource, because we're so used to and so spoiled just to turn the tap on and there it is. Only 3% of the water in the world is even potable, and 2% is actually frozen. We've only got a small amount of water to use on the whole earth. We keep recycling it, and the more efficient we can be in our gardens. I think we're ahead of the game by doing that.
I agree. Yeah, and I think it should be more of our conversation in the horticultural world about it. I think that is a very true thing. Even if you live in a place where you get plenty of water, and I consider that I do, I still think you shouldn't waste it. I think maybe, Craig, this is the beginning of more conversations about it, because I think that the people who have been talking about dry gardens, I consider it part of responsible gardening, have been those in areas of scarcity, but we all could be in scarcity. And that's what I was saying earlier on. We have had years when we've had 67 inches of rain and then years when we've got 30 something inches of rain. There's a reason they call it an average of 45, 47. That's an average. So some years you get more and some years you get less. Then everyone's, we've got no water. What am I going to do? Plan for it and make your plants resilient, get their roots down, retaining water as much as you can. I do have two rain barrels over on my carriage house. I ordered two of those from Kentucky that were used barrels. Being nosy, I had to lift the little plug off and look inside. There was nothing but very strong smell. I get a old hand crank pump that you can buy easily. You put that on the top. You have to make it easy for yourself. Then people say, what about mosquitoes when you have all this standing stuff? There is a mosquito dunk that you can use that is called Bacillus thunbergii. I might be saying that wrong, but it's a type of bacteria that infects the mosquito larvae. And also go around and empty your saucers after a while. It takes a while to complete the life cycle, but don't let that put you off water gardening. In one of our ponds, we do have fish. I feel like we go around and empty standing water out, like dustbin lids and that sort of thing.
How do you construct your dry garden, and how do you keep those plants alive even though you don't water them?
Good question. There wasn't much in the way of written stuff. There was a fledgling internet, but not much that you could look up. For whatever reason, maybe playing off my trip to the south of France, where I saw how it was important for these drought-loving lavenders and other dry-tolerant plants to get good drainage, as well as they didn't care about whether they got water or not, I decided, because my land is quite flat, even though I'm on the top of the hill, it does drain down a certain percentage, but I don't have hills and dales. So I made little mini hills and dales with mounds or berms of soil. The reason I did that is because then if it's really drought tolerant, I can put it at the top of the hill. If it needs a bit more moisture, it can go halfway down the hill. If it is less drought tolerant, it goes at the bottom of the hill. You get all these different zones, and then depending which way it faces, north, south, east, west, you can play on sun-loving plants and shade-loving plants. It sounds very intricate. You don't have to get this crazy as I am. In my dreams in the winter, I was going to get a big mound of my soil and mix it with lots of grit and gravel to increase the drainage. Then I was going to make these berms. But of course, we had a very wet spring in 2004. My neighbor thought I was building a swimming pool because I dug the center out for a patio. No time to do mixing. I also had a garden tour on May 18th for the Pennsylvania Horticulture Society. How do I know that date? Because it was a traumatic event. The lady from PHS came and it just wasn't finished. It was like 2 or 3 days before. I decided I was going to mulch these berms with gravel to give better drainage. She came on the Thursday and I was away. I got back and there was 10 tons of the wrong gravel sitting on my driveway. I phoned them up. This was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I said, you need to bring me my gravel. I've got the garden tour coming. They were like, please don't make me scoop 10 tons of gravel off your driveway. They'd have to bring all the equipment. I said, okay, that comes to me free, but then you have to deliver the right one by the end of the day. I then had 20 tons of gravel to get rid of. They mulch with gravel on the soil surface about 2 or 3 inches. Obviously, gravity plays a part. The down the bottom has more and down up the top has less. I find that inorganic mulch is perfect for things like Santalina, the dry loving herbs, for things like Euphorbia mercenites, for the Pasc flower that's out now, Pulsatilla vulgaris. I did my homework for things that have a nice taproot that come from areas of the world where they really get erratic rainfall. Erratic is one of the key words because you just don't know when it's going to rain. I did a lot of research on what plants I thought would work. When I plant them, almost the key to this, Craig, is that you almost bare root them. They come to you often in peat moss or some other organic matter. That is like the kiss of death to these plants because that will dry out very easily. Then it doesn't get its roots into the soil. I have a bucket. I dig the hole out where I'm going to plant it, push the gravel back, shake the potting soil off the roots into the bucket, maybe mix a bit of soil if I want to, and then some gravel has already fallen in the hole. It's very erratic and catch as catch can. You put it back in and push the native soil around the roots, then you push the gravel back as a sort of collar around the plant. Then I'll have a watering can of water or a bucket or something, give it a dousing. Normally never water it again.
You're only dealing with 2 inches of gravel.
About 2 or 3 inches is what I've found works best. Also, working out what size gravel, because these two different sizes that it delivered to me, one was too big. It was almost like an egg shape size one. I put that around the shrubbery, around the outside. So that's where it got lost. For my herbaceous plants, I think it's 1/4 to 3/8 is the size I use. I like a river gravel. I use the chipped gravel on the paths so you don't slip over. But on this thing, I wanted a different look. The colors in this particular river gravel go with my tumbled bluestone paths, which are dry laid.
Those are more rounded type stones.
Yes, they're rounded. I find that works well. The chipped can be quite sharp. It could cut into the tender stems and things like that, I think.
Introduce us to the 2 books you have written.
I was lucky enough to be asked by Timber Press to write a shade garden book for them because they have quite an extensive shade garden. It's an old garden with big trees. You have to think what you're going to be gardening with that. In the summer, it's my favorite place to be because it's not as hot. I hadn't really quantified the varieties of shade that there are, but it really allowed me to have an in-depth look into shade gardens and different types of shade. It has, I think, 200 genera of shade-loving plants in there. That's something for everyone. I take the photographs, so I know what exactly is in each one of those photos and can write good descriptions. That was the first one I did for Timber Press. The next one is the Ultimate Flower Gardener's Guide, and that one is the flip side. That's the sunny flower gardens. It doesn't go into trees and shrubs on that one, whereas Glorious Shade has some shrubs and vines and things. The Flower Gardener's Guide is all the types of herbaceous, cool season annuals, warm season annuals, bulbs, both tender and hardy bulbs, and perennials. That one has 175 or 6 genera and 650 photos. It's very heavily illustrated because I find that gardeners who are trying to improve their flower gardens, they need to look at inspiration. It's heavy on inspiration, sort of design, but horticulture at the same time. I love a good horticultural book, but I also spend a lot of time thinking about how to put flower gardens together. People are saying that they really enjoy that aspect of it, where I describe the shapes of flowers and how a garden with many shapes adds to the appeal, but then you can put it together by colors that you choose as well. I really enjoy writing and photographing. I'm just in the process of doing my next book for Timber Press, and I just sent the draft in recently.
Give us any hints of what it might be about?
Yes, I can give you hints. It's about bulbs, because I love my bulbs. I've got many types of daffodils out there, especially historic ones are my favorite ones. Yes, that's the next book. That's your sneak preview there, Craig.
I look forward to it.
Okay.
Speaking of inspiration, you've got your website, which is very inspiring, and also Instagram.
I have three wonderful girls. They said, Mum, you're just going to love Instagram. The Northview Garden Instagram one has been going for quite a few years now. And then my publishers decided I needed a Jenny Rose Carey one. So that's not quite as old. But if you like pretty pictures of gardens, there are a lot of pictures of flowers and gardens. I do travel. I go all over the place giving lectures. I try and post when I do that. I just got back from England less than a week ago. I'm going to be posting about a couple of gardens I went to visit. I am lucky enough to travel. I do like to share that. I am an educator by training and by inclination. I just see it as a way of sharing, educating, and showing people possibilities for their own gardens, really.
What do you find most rewarding about gardening?
I find gardening to be a complete obsession. It's an obsession that helps me mentally, physically, spiritually. I just get so passionate about it that I want to share it with everybody. I found over the years it's been my sanctuary, it's been a solace, especially during the pandemic. I felt that the gardeners amongst us really had a completely different mind place, really, than people who didn't garden. We were so lucky we could get out in the fresh air and just commune with nature and everything. I am pretty obsessed with gardening and horticulture. That's how I get my exercise. I just love being out there with the birds and seeing how things grow, watching things grow is just planting a seed. If you've never planted anything from seed, try it this spring. Start with something easy like a marigold or a zinnia, something that has a big seed, nasturtium. Those are easy ones. Zinnias are particularly, they just want to grow. Start with something easy and then just look at it every day and just say, oh my goodness, it's amazing.
Is there a particular garden style that you're really excited about?
I default to cottage garden style just by having grown up with very flowery gardens. I love to read old gardening books that I find are still very inspiring, particularly people like Gertrude Jekyll, who was an English garden writer from 100 and something years ago. People say, why do you bother reading those old garden books? They can't have anything to say. But I think they had a more holistic approach to gardening that did take in the poetry of it, as well as this is how you grow this. You make a row and you put them in a row and everything. It was more like seeing gardening as a creative outlet and something that you could think deeply about rather than just, I've got to get this done and blah, blah, blah. This is how you do it. If you do this, you're doing it wrong. There's none of that. It's I'm going to experiment and see how best to grow love in the mist or something.
What do you wish people would do differently when designing, building, or growing a garden?
I think the biggest thing I would say to people is try and put yourself and your own personality and that of your family and your friends into the garden. So instead of looking over the garden fence and saying, Mr. and Mrs. Jones have this over their garden fence. I'm going to do the same. I need to copy that. Really spend some time listening to podcasts, obviously, and pictures and things. If you're working with a designer, rip things out of magazines if you still get them, or print out things from different images or Pinterest or whatever. Really start getting your things that speak to you. Because if you do that, you will interact with the garden in a much deeper way. It will be much more your own garden rather than a formulaic thing. I think that's the biggest message I try and get across, is it doesn't have to be all of the garden, but some bits of it. Stamp your own personality on it. Really try and think what you like. I was just talking to somebody the other day. I did a recent blog post for National Garden Bureau on flowers that I like to start from seed. She said it was my dad's favorite flower. He wore it to her wedding when she married her husband. That is such a lovely story and such a lovely connection. If people just went back to who did you garden with as a child, or what did your neighbor grow that you loved, or what was in your first garden, and then incorporate even a couple of those flowers, it automatically then becomes your garden and it's much more personal. I think that's really my main message to people.
What garden myth would you like to smash?
I think the same sort of thing is your garden doesn't have to look the same as everybody else's, really. I think that's the main one. It's interesting because in preparation for this, my daughter was like, Mum, what are you going to say if Craig asked you about garden myths? She said, I'm going to Google garden myths. The first top 10 things that she came up with that were myths, I thought, I don't think that's a myth. I think I'm a bit of a, I don't know, curmudgeon springs to mind, but maybe not. But if somebody says it's a myth, I'm like, maybe I'm going to prove you wrong. I think the biggest myth is that there are rules and you need to follow them. Break a few myths and try it yourself. That's what I will say.
What is your earliest garden memory?
I do remember gardening with my grandmother. I think that's one of the early ones. She lived in the neighboring village in Kent in England. I was the oldest. My parents were busy and I would get palmed off on my granny, which I loved at the weekend. She grew a lot from seed cuttings and things like that. It was a true cottage garden. I remember doing all those things with her. And she loved flowers. She had flowers on her dining room table every day, or some leaves and twigs and things like that in the winter. She was definitely a big influence. The other thing is our little home garden was tiny. We could play in it and make mud pies and things like that. I do remember that. Taking geranium cuttings with my mother at about age 7. I just remember a lot about it. We had this, what they call an allotment, down the hill in the village that's like a community garden. It always seemed like it was such a long way away to go with the wheelbarrow and the tools and everything like that downhill, but it seemed like it was uphill both ways. My job as the oldest daughter was to do the weeding. The sun was always blaring and it was like, oh, that wasn't a good memory early on.
Why did you decide to pursue horticulture and gardening as a profession?
I've had several different careers. I started off teaching in England. I'm a science teacher by training, and I taught 11 through 18 year olds. Married my American husband, moved here to Philadelphia area. I carried on teaching, then ran my own import business for about 7 or 8 years. By this time, I had 3 children. I decided that this was the time I was going to really pursue my passion. I was lucky enough to go back to school and study horticulture, even though I have a biology degree and a teaching degree. I wanted to actually know the Latin names of oaks, believe it or not, Craig. In England, there's 1 or 2 oaks, but here you've got red oaks, scarlet oaks, white oaks, and all the whole things. And I'm like, darn, I don't know the Latin names. So it was off to school with me. Then I became an adjunct professor there. They never let me leave. Then I was the director of the Arboretum there at Temple University's Ambler campus. I was director at Meadowbrook Farm for about 7 years until sometime during the pandemic. I've been very lucky, really pursuing my passion and helping others learn as well. I really enjoy teaching.
But you've got a funny garden story that you could tell us.
Oh my goodness. all of you who invite me to lectures, watch out. There's going to be a tell-all book about all of the things that have happened when I've been speaking and things like that. This lady said I should write a book because every time I would come back, they'd be like, you'll never guess what happened. And travel is full of fraught with all the things. I was in the little town of Broadway, which is more like a village, last week. I went over to the deli, and shout out to the Broadway deli if you ever go to Broadway. It's not in New York. It's in Worcestershire. My husband thinks that wherever I go in the world, I somehow have a magnet to people that have like-minded interests. There was a dog in the way as I'm going in, so I talked to the dog, and then I went upstairs, got my breakfast, and the dog and its owner and his partner came up and had breakfast in the same room. So we start chatting, and it turns out that he is the botanist from Wales who invented No Mow May. I don't know if people have heard of that, but it's a push to leave your grass long through April and May so that the birds can live in the grass, the insects can live in the grass, and we don't use all the petrochemicals to mow it for that month. His name is Trevor the Botanist, so look him up. I am constantly fascinated by people in our industry. So many lovely conversations. I did manage to do a very spectacular entrance when I was speaking at the Northwest Flower and Garden Show last year. I was doing Container Wars. My husband was in the audience, and all of a sudden he couldn't see me because they played the Rocky theme, obviously, since I'm from Philadelphia now. I've got my arms up, and there was a bit of water on the floor, and I managed to do a slide onto the thing in the most spectacular, but of course injured my leg at the same time. I had to do the Container Wars hopping on one leg. Then I had to give a lecture sitting with my leg on a sound box.
In your professional career, who's been your biggest influencer?
I would say probably my family members from a young age, because my dad being in botany, and then my Welsh granny, she came from Wales. She loved to grow pretty much any flowers. My grandfather grew all the vegetables. That garden was magical because it had little paths that went down. As a kid, the best blackberries, apples, pears, greengages and damson, everything you could want to eat in there. Beth Chatto, who has passed, unfortunately, but she was an English gardener. If you don't know her works, look her up. Beth Chatto, C-H-A-T-T-O. She had one of the first gardens that we often use the expression right plant, right place. She was really one of the first advocates for that. I do love garden writers, particularly like Gertrude Jekyll and many other female garden writers who are innovative and who I feel are like my mentors.
What's your most valuable garden mistake?
Oh, where should we start with mistakes? I think because I'm an experimental gardener, I have made more mistakes than your average person because I like to try things. The list is pretty endless. I would probably say it's planting things in the wrong place, because if you plant them in the wrong place the first time, you're communing with your plants and looking at how they're doing, you realize, whoops, this is not growing. For example, I got muddled up early on in my gardening between the sun-loving creeping phlox and the shade-loving creeping phlox. I think I must have switched them because neither was doing well. The other thing that I did, Craig, as a horticulturist, would buy one of everything. When you buy one of everything, it's a collection, not really a garden. One of my other gardening mentors, I have had many, many of whom have been women through garden clubs and herb societies and things like that. She came to my garden and she said, do you never buy more than one of anything? I'm like, no, I don't. Why? I was younger. I didn't have the money. So I just bought one of things because I wanted to see what it did. Then I would propagate it. The resulting garden was pretty bitty. So that was probably another big lesson that I learned, is if you can either buy one plant and rip it into two or three, do that, or save up for buying three of them and making it a bit more of a designed garden rather than a onesie garden.
What have you recently learned about horticulture or gardening?
I would like to say I learn something every day. I really do try and learn something new every day. I think that the things I learn now are more, because I've spent so long doing this, the things that I learn now are more like oh, I really want that plant or I like this plant. It's more personal. I do have my list of plants that I'm not going to be able to live without this year. It's an ongoing obsession. So I don't think I have one particular thing that I've learned recently, but maybe it's just that I really want more plants. I don't know.
I'd like for you to complete this statement. In my garden, I have
so many plants, you wouldn't believe it, is the answer to that one. Because I have prided myself on, I grow zone 6-7. I'm right on the border between zone 6 and 7. In the recent USDA reshuffle, I've turned to a 7, but I know I'm not a 7 because I'm up on this slight hill here. I really have been trying to grow anything that I can grow in this climate. And I have 4.5 acres, so I've got a lot of room to play. I have a lot of shrubs. I have some really nice trees. I try and garden for all seasons. So I have a winter walk. I have spring areas. I have summer areas. I have autumn areas. I do make sure I have something that is in bloom every day of the year if I can.
What did you learn from your garden last year that you're going to apply this following year?
More is what I learned. For example, I was just buying gladiolus, which I know people think of as the funeral flower, but I'm like, I don't think I had enough last year. I think there's maybe a theme here, Craig, that, you know, but I just bought more yesterday. I'm like, oh, I think I need more. I think along that theme is succession, because say you buy 25 gladiolus in a bag, right? Or you buy a pack of zinnia seeds. The temptation is, it's a nice sunny weekend day, so you go out and plant all of them. Then all the gladiolus come up on one day, like 6-8 weeks later, and you think, am I starting a funeral parlor? Or you have one big, huge vase of 25 gladiolus. The thing that I've really learned over the last few years, it was during the pandemic, it came to the realization that you have to keep planting. We get the spring fever, we plant a lot of things in the spring, and then they come to maturity in the summer, and then they tail off during the fall. But if you do some gladiolus now, 2 weeks' time, you do another set of gladiolus, 2 weeks' time, you do another one, then they come in all in a nice sequence. The same with zinnias or even herbs or anything like that. So you plant some zinnias early, then you put a few more seeds in later, and then you put a few more in later. Those are the ones that are going to take you through to fall rather than the ones that you put in April.
Tell us about your latest bout of creativity in your garden.
The latest one is just ongoing. I get obsessed with something and then off we go. It's just a really ongoing thing, but probably the herb garden is going to be it this year. In the last few years, I've done a lot in containers, which I don't really need to do in a garden this big, but we've been making these lovely vignettes. Hannah, my lovely gardener, I keep telling you about, she and I are collaborating, but she's very good at this. What we do is grow one type of plant in each container rather than trying to get them all in one. I love the big containers that you do like different things all in the same one. But what we're doing is there'll be some heucheras in one. There'll be some tulips in another. There'll be some sedums in another. Then just bring to the front the ones that are looking the best, then push to the back the ones that aren't looking so good. We've been loving doing that. That is so creative. You can do that on a patio, a balcony, or anything like that. Having these individual containers that are small enough that you can move around, it means if they're not in enough sun, you can move them to more sun. If they're in too much sun, you can move them. If they're getting too much water, you can water them less. It gives you so much to play with. I would say our container vignettes.
What plant are you in love with this week?
Daffodils. We're on daffodil season up here in Pennsylvania. There's one called Smiling Twin. I think it's from Brent and Becky's Bulbs. It has a quite flat face and it has the two heads. Oh my goodness, I've got some downstairs. Daffodils definitely this week, and all of the historic ones that were released prior to 1940, then just anything else that takes my fancy, including some of the miniatures that are out, like Little Witch, Mite, Tiny Bubbles, or look up the miniature. If you've never grown miniature daffodils, they need more like a rock garden situation because they're so tiny. I'm really in love with Elka. I don't know if you've seen Elker. It's a light yellow, which is a very good mixing color. The other one that I'm going to suggest is one that most people don't know that's called a Bulbocodium daffodil. It's all trumpet and not much outside. So look up Bulbocodium daffodil and you'll see what I mean. The little thing is only like 8-10 inches tall, but it's all trumpet and not much outside.
I can check off what I've learned today off my list. I didn't know there was a such thing as the miniature daffodils.
Yes, it's an opportunity for serious obsession, just saying.
Do you want to have a wrap-up statement, or what you said the last would be great? If you want to wrap it up with a statement, that'd be great.
I think, Craig, that people should have more fun in their garden and just experiment and grow more of what grows well for you, but also that you love. I like to think of it as a Venn diagram. In one circle, there are all the plants that really do well in your garden. In the other circle, there are all the things that you can't garden without. You put them together and see if there's any in that overlapping bit of the two circles. Those are the ones that you need to concentrate on lots, the ones that grow in your garden, but also you're passionate about. If you are growing one thing successfully, look at its close relatives, because there might be other things that you don't even know about that are closely related to it that will do equally well in your garden. Keep on finding new things as well. That's what keeps us all young in gardening.
How about Northview Garden? When is it open and where can we tour it?
Northview Garden is open primarily for tours, like with a garden club or something like that. Also by special arrangement. This year, for the first time, we've been doing a series of open garden days, which there's one coming up on April 23rd. In a couple of weeks' time, there is one the 3rd of June, and then I will be doing at least one this fall. If you belong to a club of any sort, or if you're touring by bus, please look up America's Garden Capital, which is this Philadelphia area. We have 30-odd public gardens within 30 miles of Philadelphia. I hope to see you here.
Jenny Rose, tell us how people may connect with you.
The best way to reach me is through my website, jennyrosecarey.com, or through my Instagram. I have two handles. One is @JennyRoseCarey, and the other one is @NorthviewGarden.
This has been episode 158, Smart Water Practices and Your Garden, with Jenny Rose Carey on the Garden Question Podcast. Thank you, Jenny Rose. You're awesome. The goal is that every episode is valuable and well worth your time. Please generously share the Garden Question Podcast with your friends, relatives, and neighbors. Check out our website, thegardenquestion.com, for links, resources, and where you can listen to every episode again and again. You will not want to miss a weekly episode, so please subscribe to the Garden Question Podcast with Craig McManus on your favorite listening app. Keep on designing, building, and growing a smarter garden that works.